Hello and welcome to A Mindful Emergence on WPVM. My name is Eddie Lesher, and I'll be joined very soon by my co-host Margaret Kirshner and our special guests for this week. We come to you live every Monday evening from 7 to 8 p.m. at 103.7 on your FM radio dial, or you can stream us globally at WPVMFM.org. This program is also rebroadcast Thursday mornings from 9 to 10 a.m. Our focus each week is on various aspects of recovery, discussing topics such as addiction, trauma, wellness, healing, self-care, and personal transformation, as we take an in-depth and informative look into approaches that can be integrated into daily life. All our programs are underwritten by A Mindful Emergence, a locally owned LLC that's committed to bringing integrated solutions into addiction recovery and trauma relief, utilizing body-centered mindfulness, self-compassion, and therapeutic movement practices. For more information, our website is amindfulemergence.com. And I want to welcome our listening audience into yet another edition of our program, A Mindful Emergence. And at this time, say hello to my co-host, Margaret Kirshner.
Hi, everyone. Good to be here.
And at this point, I want to welcome our guests. And we're very happy to be joined in the studio this week by Laura Eshelman and Michelle Guichenet from The Steady Collective. And the theme this week is promoting wellness, empowerment, and respect for people using drugs. And the Steady Collective is an organization that is really promoting the wellness of people who use drugs by reducing the rate of drug overdose and the spread of infectious disease with education, advocacy, and direct services. So I've asked our guests, Laura and Michelle, to kind of give us an idea what the Steady Collective does and what our focus is going to be on this week.
Well, Eddie, I think you kind of encapsulated it with that description. More specifically, as far as the direct services that the Steady Collective provides, we are a needle exchange program in Asheville. We also provide avenues for people to safely dispose of used syringes and needles. We provide naloxone, more commonly known as Narcan. We also offer demonstrations and education about how to use Narcan. And we also track overdose reversals in Buncombe County.
So, Michelle, it's safe to say that this is a harm reduction program. Could you just say, what does that mean, harm reduction? And how does that philosophy fit in?
Well, harm reduction means being aware of one's safety.
Mm-hmm.
I always compare that with the safety belt in a car. You're going to drive your car, you put your safety belt, that's harm reduction.
Okay.
And in what we do, so besides the aspect of infectious disease and overdose reversal through Narcan, what we do is a connection one-on-one with the people we serve. And very often, all what you have to do is just to listen.
Yeah. So you're treating the individuals that you're working with as people, not as annoying pests or numbers or statistics. Fair to say?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah.
And that means a lot.
Yeah, I think that what makes the Steady Collective unique in a lot of respects is that the participants that we have, our relationship with them is not contingent on where they are as far as their use, whether they have been in recovery for a long time or if they're in the middle of chaotic use. That information is not is not what we're concerned with. As Michelle said, we're concerned with safety. And just like the analogy that he used to a car, we pass no more moral judgment on somebody's decision to engage in a risk-taking behavior like driving a car than we do with using IV drugs.
So we're going to explore this epidemic that exists now in the risks involved and talk in depth about the work that you do and the impact on the community. But I'd like to explore your backgrounds a little bit. And we'll start with you, Michelle. Mm-hmm. Obviously, you weren't born in New Jersey or Georgia.
No, actually, I was born in Madison County.
Right. Okay, Madison County in...
France.
France, yes. Yes.
Yeah, it's quite the equivalent because I'm a country guy.
Uh-huh.
I grew up in the country, which was, you know, fantastic. And as far as my personal background, I always like to tell a little story.
Please.
Very short. Yeah, both my parents were therapists. End of the story.
That's trouble right there. I mean, how can you grow up normal?
That's right, that's right.
No chance.
So I got very interested at an early age to play music. And I did that while going to high school, sort of. Mm-hmm. And eventually, just my last year in high school, I dropped off and I went to play.
What style of music were you playing?
Oh, back then it was really heavy metal.
Okay.
Type AC/DC and
uh-huh.
You know.
You're a headbanger.
Kind of. Yeah, kind of.
Uh-huh. Okay. So you dropped out of high school.
Mm-hmm. And you know, I guess I was not too bad of a guitar player because I was able to make a living out of that.
Mm-hmm.
And then I moved to Paris, and then things started, you know, working out. I was getting into recording studios, but somewhere in that narrative, heroin kicked in. And heroin was a substance that I have stayed away for a long time because I was really scared of it. And
for good reason.
For very good reason. And the minute I got high, I was like, oh, my God.
That's it. You were gone.
That was it. And the honeymoon with that substance lasted a very short time.
Mm-hmm.
4 weeks.
Wow.
Using every day. And after 4 weeks, I woke up one morning and I was sick. And that was the story. The chaos lasted for 15 years, and during these 15 years, since at the time in France there was no access to clean syringes.
So obviously you were intravenously
injecting.
Yeah,
IV user. Yeah, mm-hmm. IV user. And so when someone has a rig, everybody was using it.
Mm-hmm.
It's just, you know, the way it was. And I contracted Hep C then.
Hepatitis C?
Hepatitis C, yeah.
Mm-hmm.
And hepatitis C is a very slow evolving condition. And by the time you have, you know, symptoms, it's very, very well advanced. I was diagnosed officially with that in 2010, and I was supposed to do the old treatment with interferon, but my liver was in very bad shape, and at the last moment they said, no, you can't do that treatment, you need a liver transplant. I stayed on the waiting list for a year, got the liver transplant.
Was this in France? Or you, by that time, you had moved to the States?
Yeah. I moved in 97 to the States.
Okay.
So you get a new liver, they put it in, and they leave it about 6 to 9 months, so the body gets used to it, and then they were going to start the treatment, the old treatment. Things went bad fast, right after the transplant. Virus came back with a roar. After 6 months, 50% of my new liver was
gone.
I ended up, you know, I was yellow. I was hooked up to a dialysis machine. My prognostic was not good at all. So much so that the doctors asked me to write my advance directive and to call my family at my bedside. So I've learned after the fact that their prognostic was zero chance. I was not going to make it. And I almost didn't make it. That was an all other different experience that I had. So here I was with another 20 years, you know, lease on life. What am I going to do with that time? 9-to-5 job? Making money? And it just happened that I heard Michael Harney on a radio station, and he was, you know, explaining what he was doing, and I was like, that's it.
And who is this?
Michael Harney. He's the original person who established a syringe exchange.
Okay. And where is
in
he?
In Asheville.
And he's in Asheville.
Yeah, he's in Asheville.
Okay, so you heard that he had a program going.
This was before it was legal.
Okay.
And so he had a program, and you know, I just volunteered. I said, what do you need to do? So I did whatever I had to do.
Mm-hmm.
And I did that for quite a few months, and I got in touch. I got introduced to Hillary, Connor Adams, and Peggy Wheel. And these four musketeers were the origin of Steady Collective.
And when was it founded?
It was founded in...
I joined the board in late 2016, and I think the Steady Collective had been around for a year and some change at that point.
Yeah.
It started out as a support group for people using drugs, not necessarily in recovery, just as sort of a social network for folks who needed community support and they weren't finding it elsewhere. And it's since grown into an organization that provides direct service and education.
Okay. So the story that you told, Michelle, is pretty compelling. The addiction, the damage, and the fact that you got a new lease on life. How unusual is this? It's not that unusual, is it? A lot of people deal with some pretty serious consequences from intravenous drug use and sharing needles.
Mm-hmm.
Pretty common in the crowd you ran with.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Very common.
So how much, Laura, is this going on now where there's a lot of shared needles and high risk for hepatitis and HIV transmission?
I do not have any numbers on hand, but to give you some perspective, syringe exchange has only been legalized in North Carolina for about a year.
I think
it's been in effect. So one statistic I can offer is that when somebody doesn't have access to a source for clean syringes, the average needle gets reused about 50 times.
Oh, my God.
And if you look at a microscopic picture of what a needle looks like after 6 times of use, it's pretty disturbing. It becomes barbed at the end, and it's much more likely to tear at the veins and cause abscesses. So, you know, that's one health consequence. And because drug users are so isolated from the rest of the population, particularly IV users, of course those needles are going to get shared in those communities. So, I mean, one other example that I can point to is the community in Indiana that had the HIV outbreak when they did not have access to clean needles. So I think it's very prevalent. Hep C is one of those things that we don't talk about quite as much as HIV because it's not as shocking to people. Having worked in milieus with people who are in recovery, though, it's extremely common.
Yeah.
And that's to say nothing of other bacterial infections. Endocarditis is something that commonly occurs with dirty needle use.
Mm. So you, unlike Michelle, do not have a history of intravenous drug use. What got you interested? You're obviously passionate about this. You're on the board. What brought you to do this, to make this commitment?
Laura?
Well, the short of it is that I started volunteering with the North Carolina Harm Reduction Coalition in late 2012. And in 2013 is when we saw a lot of movement on the harm reduction front, despite having an extremely conservative legislature. NC Harm Reduction was an organization that pushed for and successfully pushed for the Good Samaritan Law. For listeners who aren't familiar, that is the law where if you were in the company of somebody that is overdosing, you can call 911 and you are immune from prosecution even if you have small amounts of drugs or paraphernalia on you. That has since been extended to people who are also on probation and violation. That was also the year that we saw the naloxone bill passed, which allowed third-party people, so people who weren't necessarily prescribed it by a doctor, to receive it from organizations like NC Harm Reduction. So I wasn't familiar with the concept before my friend encouraged me to volunteer with this organization. And the more I learned about what was going on at the state level and the concept of harm reduction to begin with, the stronger I felt about it. I've also struggled with mental illness and recovery from eating disorders in my own life. So it was a philosophy that I found applicable to myself. I have used drugs in the past, so I felt a lot of empathy for the folks that we were serving, saw a lot of common connections, and that volunteer job became an internship and continued as a volunteer job. And so when the Study Collective became a thing and I was invited to be on the board, it was something that I jumped at.
If you just tuned in, you're listening to A Mindful Emergence on the new WPVM LP in Asheville, North Carolina. You can find us at 103.7 on your radio dial, and we stream globally at WPVMFM.org. And Margaret and I are joined in the studio this week by Laura Eshelman and Michelle Guichenet from the Steady Collective, promoting wellness and empowerment and respect for people using drugs. And you do this through the distribution of clean syringes. I understand in 2017, Steady Collective distributed over 73,000 new syringes, collected 13,692 used syringes for proper disposal, handed out 1,762 naloxone kits, stumbled over that one a little bit, naloxone, and this has really directly impacted people, and you've received 258 overdose reversal reports from people who use the kits. Those are incredible numbers. Who are you guys? Do you wear capes and, you know, leap from tall buildings? I mean, this is a tremendous effort.
One point that I want to speak to as far as the overdose reversals go, and bear in mind that the numbers that you just gave are what we hear reported.
Yeah.
They are not all of the overdose reversals that take place. Something that you don't hear about in the news very often is that the people that are performing these reversals are people that are using drugs.
Yeah.
When they have the tools to save themselves, they will do it. Mm-hmm. It has been a struggle to express that need to public services. For example, the Asheville Police Department does not carry Narcan, or at least they didn't until recently a teenager purchased kits for them. They are not using their budget to buy Narcan kits. So in the meantime, the community is taking care of itself. So I think when we're talking about everyday heroes, I really want to give a shout out to our participants, because they're the ones that are doing some of the hardest work out there.
So I just pulled this out of my bag. What do I have here, Michelle?
Here, apparently we have a kit. Oh, sorry. Here, apparently we have a kit. Let me see what it is.
Yeah, it says opioid overdose kit.
Yes.
So it looks like one of the intramuscular ones.
Mm-hmm. So, yeah, talk about, we may have many listeners, naloxone or Narcan are like foreign, you know, they have no idea. What exactly are they, and how do they work?
So Narcan is the brand name of naloxone.
Okay.
And what naloxone does is when somebody has an overdose, the neuroreceptors get flooded with opioids that, you know, mimic the neurotransmitters and get, you know, in the brain and clog actually the neuroreceptor. And that's when the brain starts sending, you know, crazy signals like stop breathing.
Mm-hmm.
And so that's what happened with an overdose. So what naloxone does, it gets into the bloodstream and uncap the neuroreceptors. So the correct information can go through, and so the person can breathe again.
Mm-hmm.
So in this kit, the intramuscular kits, you got two syringes and two vials. So the by the book protocol with an overdose is, so you realize the person is unresponsive. You do a sternum rub.
Or a stash rub, right?
Or a stash rub here.
Mm-hmm. Michelle is rubbing his knuckles against his upper lip below his nose. Or, and Laura's showing how you rub on the chest. What does that do?
It's extremely painful. When done correctly, if somebody is responsive, they will wake up and probably cuss you out a little
bit. Okay, what you want.
Yeah, so if they're not responding to verbal commands and they're not responding to that, and if there's other telltale signs at that point, if their skin is turning gray, if their lips are turning blue, then you're in trouble.
Okay. So we have these vials, we have these syringes. What happens next?
Well, next, you uncap your vial, put the syringe in it. Suck it in. It doesn't matter if you have air bubbles, because you're going to shoot in a muscle. So the muscle could be
In the butt.
In the thigh.
Upper arm. Okay. Because it's not going in the veins, you're not worrying about the bubbles.
Yes, exactly.
To revive them. Now, we also, Margaret and I also have nasal spray bottles that we have access to. You're reaching in your pocket. Okay. So that's exactly what we have, because we work in the field, and there's always a high risk for someone to overdose. Well, even when you don't work in the field, you never know when you're going to encounter someone.
And you're exactly right.
So how hard are these to access, these kits?
So actually, there's a standing order for North Carolina, which means anybody can go to any pharmacy and buy Narcan.
Okay.
The cost is roughly around $50.
Mm-hmm.
If you have Medicaid, it's $3.
Wow.
So anybody can go. That's not to say that every pharmacist is selling Narcan, because the final decision belongs to the pharmacist.
Mm-hmm.
And if he feels like it's a no, it's a no.
So let's talk about that, because we're up against public perception to a large extent. You mentioned, Laura, that syringe exchange wasn't even legal until, what, a year ago?
About a year ago, yes.
And this is because, what took so long?
I think that really the reason that syringe exchange took so long in North Carolina, and really why, you know, just culturally across this country, there's been a reluctance to accept it as a public health strategy, is that folks oftentimes see it as facilitating drug use. Mm-hmm. In fact, there's been a backlash against the use of Narcan, because often, you know, when somebody is in active use, they may require a number of overdose reversals, especially now that what we're seeing on the street is, you know, the heroin is less pure. It's cut with fentanyl, carfentanil, which are stronger substances, and they require more Narcan than they used to. So the argument there is that Narcan and needle exchanges enable stable drug use. But at the same time, you know, if somebody's dead, they're never going to get into treatment. If somebody is dealing with mounting health costs because of Hep C, or because they've been diagnosed with HIV, or because they're in the hospital with a bacterial infection, then that's also going to make it more difficult for them to get recovery afterward. So it is not really about reducing drug use. It's about improving public health for everybody, and keeping people safe until and if they reach a point where they decide that they do not want to use anymore.
It might be important for people to realize that studies have shown that syringe exchange programs do not increase crime or drug use, and provide a gateway to drug treatment and HIV prevention services. And in addition, these programs do not encourage the initiation of drug use or the frequency of drug use among current users.
This is true.
Yeah. So, in your experience, when you were on the street, was there the availability of these harm reduction kits around, Michelle?
Well, the one that we are handing out, yes.
It was.
But that's about it. Mm-hmm. Even if there is an open order in pharmacies, when you live in the streets, if you have $5 left in your pocket, what do? You're going to go get some Narcan or go get some dope?
Yeah. Yeah.
So having naloxone kits hitting the streets actually helps a lot at many different levels. The first one is, of course, people are being resuscitated, so they live. But also, we at the City Collective try to involve the population we're serving in what we're doing, mm-hmm. Because that's something we're doing together.
How do you do that?
Well, I'm glad you asked that question.
That's my job.
Yep, that's right, that's right. one of the main thing is consistency, meaning, for instance, at that table that we have at the Harewood Street congregation, I was there every Wednesday, or somebody from Steady was there every Wednesday, when all we could hand out were naloxone kits, information, condoms, whatnot. And we would be there all the time, every Wednesday, rain, shine. The majority of the population we serve at these outreach tables are people experiencing homelessness. And we see a lot of people with mental illness, and we see a combination of the three, people experiencing homelessness with mental illness and drug use disorder. So they watch, you know, what you're about, because people who live out in the streets are not used to have, you know, people just coming to them and just offering a service, no strings attached, no judgment. I don't care. We just want to keep you safe.
How hard is it to build trust with them?
I was going to say, if you're true, if you're real, for real, it's going to happen.
Yeah.
It's going to happen.
And they can probably spot a phony or someone with a hidden agenda.
Absolutely.
We call it a BS detector. What do you call BS?
Detector,
yes. I would say it a different way, but we have the FCC to contend with.
Well, more often than I think people realize, a lot of healthcare providers, in addition to perpetuating the kind of stigma that makes drug users maybe not want to come back and reuse services, is that they're in cahoots with law enforcement.
Yeah.
So that's one thing that we have to establish right away, is that we have absolutely no connection to the city police or to the sheriff's department. This isn't a ruse. Mm-hmm. We're not taking down their information so that we can pass it along, that we are just there to give them what they need when they need it.
Yeah. I'm sure the word gets around after a while. I mean, you know, hey, these people are here to help us. Go see them. You know, the best advertising is word of mouth, right?
Yeah.
Well, we're going to take a pause, and you're listening to A Mindful Emergence on 103.7 WPVM in Asheville, and I'm going to return. Margaret has to leave to go teach yoga to some folks who are in recovery, and I'm going to be hanging out with Laura and Michelle, continuing to talk about harm reduction programs offered by the Steady Collective. But I've got a piece of music that I selected, and it's actually one of our favorite bands. I don't know if they're still active or not, but Cowboy Junkies, and a Lou Reed song with some lyrics that people are still trying to figure out, called Sweet Jane. There we have Cowboy Junkies. Love that song, Sweet Jane. And this is Eddie LeSure, and from 7 to 8 p.m. every Monday on WPVM, Margaret Kirshner and I are joined by guests who share their unique experience and expertise in their effort to support personal and planetary healing and wholeness. In addition to tuning in at 103.7 FM or WPVMFM.org, Mondays from 7 to 8 p.m. when we go live, or Thursdays from 9 to 10 a.m. for this rebroadcast, past programs are archived on our show host page for your convenience. It's easy to find them. You just go to our website, open up the schedule, and find this program listed Monday nights at 7. And we're broadcasting live Monday, February 19th, 2018, and this is program 110. All our shows are made possible by a Mindful Emergence LLC, our Asheville-based company that offers classes, workshops, and one-on-one support for individuals living in recovery or wanting to experience recovery. And you can access more information online at amindfulemergence.com. You can also find us on Facebook and LinkedIn. And there are a lot of great shows on WPVM. I encourage you to go to the schedule and check them out. And one in particular that you might find enjoyable if you like this show that you're listening to is one that is hosted by McNair Ezard on Thursdays at 5 p.m. It's called A Better World. And this is a show where he brings in people and organizations that are working in areas such as hunger and poverty, economic and social justice, and the environment and spirituality. So I invite you to check that out. I think McNair does a great job with that program and has wonderful guests just like we do here. And this week it happens to be Laura Eshelman and Michelle Guichenet from the Steady Collective. And we're talking about promoting wellness and empowerment, respect for people using drugs through harm reduction. So speaking of websites, would you like to give out the website for Steady Collective so people can connect with you guys?
So the website is www.thesteadycollective.org.
Very straightforward. And I understand, Laura, you have a forum coming up. Please tell us about that.
Yes, we do. This Friday at 6:30 p.m., so that would be Friday, February 23rd at 6:30 p.m., we have a panel of local harm reductionists who will be speaking at the Haywood Street Congregation Church at... do you have the street address, Michelle? Is it?
I think it's 294-297 Haywood Street.
Haywood Street.
What, so what cross streets is that?
Patton and Haywood. Yeah,
Patton Street. And Haywood, right downtown.
Yes, and I think what the reason that this panel came about is in the wake of the opioid crisis or the opioid epidemic, if you want to call it, and I have some feelings about that word, however you want to describe
don't
it.
Don't hold back.
So I won't. I guess what bothers me the most about the fact that this is referred to as an opioid epidemic is that the way I see it, the drug use that we're seeing and the tragedies that go along with that are a symptom of a deeper epidemic. You know, people don't just pick up drugs on a whim, especially in the kind of society that we have that sanctions them so much. What we're seeing is an epidemic of poverty. What we're seeing is an epidemic of joblessness. We are seeing an epidemic of people that have psychological wounds that need healing, and they're, you know, looking for available solutions. And guess what? It just so happens that the forces that be have made it, you know, so that opioids are easier to get than substantial mental health treatment. So that ties it around to this forum and why we're having it. We've had so many community discussions and forums and panels with so-called experts, doctors and law enforcement and licensed social workers, but we haven't had any discussions from people that actually use, perhaps from people that have been in recovery for a while. But as far as the people who are the most directly impacted, we haven't heard their voices. And we haven't really heard too many harm reductionists speak on these panels either. So the folks that will be speaking at this panel are Hillary from the Steady Collective, and I believe Michelle is also on this panel. Michael Harney, who we mentioned earlier from WinCap, who did something pretty radical by beginning an underground syringe exchange program in a southern state. And also Adrian Sigmund from Beloved House, which provides services to folks with unstable housing and without housing in the community, without the stipulations that other shelters provide. So folks that are not just serving, but working alongside people who are the most directly impacted.
People in the trenches.
People in the trenches. And at some point we will have a panel of, or at least we're hoping to have a panel of folks that are directly impacted, that is active users.
So that's this coming Friday, the 23rd at 6 p.m. at the Haywood Street Congregation. Do I have that information correct?
6:30.
Yes. 6:30.
Yeah, yeah. And this is a free of charge event.
So anybody can show up and take part in it and learn. And, you know, if people want to get involved with what you're doing, if people share that same passion, do you have room for them? Is there, how can they help out?
Well, I think that even with a diversity of opinions about what the vision of a solution would look like, you know, a mutual interest that we all have is making sure that people in our community stay alive, that people are healthy, that people don't feel isolated or marginalized, and that we all have a place at the table. Or at least I hope that's what a shared vision would be.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, I think just awareness and learning and curiosity is one thing that people can do. You know, it starts there. And of course, if folks do have spare time, we have volunteer opportunities at STEADY, and there's also organizations like the one I just mentioned, Beloved House, that can always use volunteers and helping hands and other services in the area that that, you know, work to support folks that don't have support in other places.
Mm-hmm. So this is really about having compassion for people who are suffering, is really what it comes down to. Compassion rather than judgment, rather than taking a high moral ground. I'm sure there are people out there that, I don't mean to be harsh, but they just don't get it. Mm-hmm. They don't understand that the individuals who are using, they're just tired of being in pain. They're Absolutely. Really just looking for comfort as best as they know how.
Mm-hmm.
And you're reaching out and you're connecting and you're saying, we care. We're going to treat you like a human being because that's who you are. We're going to have compassion, and we're going to offer what we can to try to lessen your suffering and obviously connect them with other resources.
Yeah, and what we see is a lot of desperation.
Yeah.
And that's... I feel it's different from what we've experienced in the past because the desperation level was not that evident. And one thing we need to have a clear view on is, so we all hear about the opioids epidemic, but it's just one aspect. Methamphetamine is running wild.
It still is?
More than ever.
Oh, really? I thought maybe that had kind of ebbed, but not the case, huh?
As a matter of fact, trends are showing that as we're getting closer to a plateau with the opioid epidemic, trying to find a replacement word, but as that is taking place, methamphetamine use is on the rise.
Really?
Anytime you have a strictly prohibited substance, a natural byproduct of that is that that product is going to become more powerful and more impure. And we are certainly seeing that with meth as we did with opiates.
And is most of the usage intravenous of meth?
It's everything, really. It varies.
So there, totally. Some of them are inhaling. Some can you? You have to excuse me. My history with drugs goes back quite a ways, so I'm not up to date on what's happening. I believe me, I had my run back in the day, but. Do people smoke meth?
Yes, they do.
They're smoking meth.
I would say that smoking it is probably the most common, but it's absolutely not unheard of for people to graduate to IV use. And it's also something that you can snort. And if you take Adderall, there really is only one chemical bond of difference between so-called street meth and Adderall or Vinase or any of these prescription medications, mm-hmm. just for a bit of perspective.
Mm-hmm.
So you can take it in pill form.
Wow.
Yeah, and what we do see a lot at the outreach tables is people who are seriously mentally ill that are not treated.
Yeah.
And I mean, literally, they self-medicate with whatever.
Whatever they can find.
Whatever they can find. But meth is a great concern because it's purer than ever. Somehow a chemist managed to get the so-called best of it.
Yeah.
And it's cheap.
Oh, yeah?
Cheap.
There's a method called shake and bake where you can literally make at least something, you know, chemically similar to pure methamphetamine in plastic bottles. It's also dangerous because they can explode.
Yeah. Yeah. I just, Margaret and I just watched Breaking Bad. We went all the way through and, you know, I don't know how realistic that is.
I had a discussion once with a Columbia neuroscientist by the name of Dr. Carl Hart, who is pretty famous in the world of harm reduction because he's done a lot of groundbreaking research on drugs and drug use. He despises the show Breaking Bad because while the drug is not healthy for anybody to take, what we see a lot of the time with exacerbated drug use, be it methamphetamines, opiates, what have you, it's the lifestyle that goes along with the drugs, the not sleeping, being too scared to go to a healthcare provider and get a checkup, or not eating. The drug again is a symptom of a greater problem.
And in both cases, with every drug, they're in high-risk situations. Describe some of the places where people are going and getting these drugs.
I'm sorry to say, but it can be anywhere.
Anywhere? It's not necessarily in some of what I might perceive as the most dangerous places.
Yeah, no. It's all over the board. And literally, it can be anywhere.
But obviously, some of those places, you can get shot, stabbed, robbed, raped.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yes.
So there's that as well.
It's difficult to say also because a lot of that, you know, that a lot of that data is coming from arrests. But
yeah,
who are the folks that are getting arrested? They're the people that are already most visible to law enforcement, people that don't have secure housing, people that are over-policed in public housing. So, again, it's very difficult to say because some of the drug use that happens in more affluent white communities isn't being monitored or observed. So we have no real way of knowing, just how prevalent that is. It's a dark figure.
And people are overdosing and dying in those neighborhoods, too.
Yeah, and unfortunately, I think that's why a lot of the focus and, you know, this new trend of sympathy is a thing now, is because it is starting to affect white middle-class Americans. I mean, there have been times in history when it's affected people of color in greater numbers, and the response there was to impose higher criminal sanctions and to expand mass incarceration.
Well, I'm a big jazz fan, and I'm a jazz historian. And, of course, if you study the history of jazz, you study the history of those communities, which was, you know, it's predominantly an African-American art form, of course. And we saw the flood of narcotics into those communities. We saw police harassment of the musicians. And we saw one musician after another dying, you know, whether it was Charlie Parker or whoever it was. And then you're a rock and roller. You know, we've seen it in that community. So it's just taken a horrific toll. I did want to mention, while we're on the subject of music, I want to plug next week's show. You're still playing. You're still performing, Michel, as a musician.
I do.
Do you ever hear of a guy named Ricky Bird? He was lead guitarist for Joni Jett in the Blackhawks and has performed with a large number of other musicians. He's actually in the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame. And next week on the program, we're gonna have him on the phone. He's recorded an album, and the theme next week is rock and roll and addressing addiction, that addresses addiction recovery. So he has dedicated his life, as some other musicians have, to using his talents to educate and support recovery from addiction. He is also, like you and me, a person in long and Laura as well, in long-term recovery. You've shared that you had your struggles as well in a different way. So that's next week's show. So Ricky Bird, he's a hell of a guitarist, apparently. So, but there's a lot of good ones out there. So where are you located? I know you're at the Haywood Street. What's that called?
Haywood Street Congregation.
So talk about where you're located and when and how this actually operates.
So we are on Haywood Street, in the building of the Haywood Street Congregation, which is 297 Haywood Street, corner of Haywood Street and Patton Avenue downtown. We have two different days. We open on Tuesdays from 10 a.m. to 1 p.m. and on Wednesdays from 12 p.m. to 3 p.m.
The exchange hours on Tuesday are at Firestorm Books and Coffee, which is on Haywood Road. I believe it's 600 Haywood
in
Road.
West Asheville.
In West Asheville, yes.
Mm-hmm. Okay, so two different places that people can go. So how does it work? You just show up with your old syringes?
If you do have old syringes, you can bring them. If you don't have any syringes, that's fine too.
You can come and get some.
You can go and get some.
Yeah, so you're not using some that have been used by other people.
Absolutely.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Also, in order for the legalities to fully be in effect, I believe our participants are given cards that they carry around with them. So according to the law, if they are stopped by law enforcement and they have this card and they do happen to have needles on them, then they should be immune from prosecution.
Hmm. So I want to circle back to the law enforcement. And, you know, I don't want to get anybody in trouble or... you know, whatever, but...
That's my specialty.
Okay, well, all right, bring it on, she says. It sounds to me like you're not getting a lot of support from local law enforcement on this. What would you like to say about that? And how can the community help in that regard?
That's a loaded question.
I know it is.
Well, if you look even a little bit at the history of the war on drugs, the police have had their MO, and you know, we've got ours, and you know, the two are in many ways diametrically opposed to each other. So I think it's safe to say that we're not really seeking the support of law enforcement. We don't necessarily want a partnership with law enforcement because their MO is to arrest and prosecute people who use drugs, and ours is to support them and make sure that they're safe and that they can live quality lives. What I think we would like to see is more of a hands-off approach from law enforcement, especially when it comes to nonviolent drug crimes, and to respect the people that we serve. And unfortunately, we do hear a lot of horror stories about the kind of abuse and harassment and profiling that folks suffer at the hands of law enforcement. And I think, again, going back to what the community can do is just, you know, re-examine your own views on drug users and your own stigma. You know, that can be really hard to deconstruct, but I believe that a lot of people erroneously believe that the police are keeping drug users safe from themselves, and nobody's safe when they're detoxing in jail. There are not the proper resources to take care of somebody when they're in that state. That's not what a detention center is for. It's for caging people. So it really needs to be reframed as a public health issue rather than a criminal justice issue. And of course, there are ancillary behaviors that are of the criminal element. You know, there's theft and there's, you know, violence that sometimes happens. But, you know, if you take a step back and look at the policies that criminalize the drugs to begin with and how those behaviors grow out of it, it really stems from reeling back on prohibition. Mm-hmm. So keep aware of local law and kind of look at where those judgments are coming from the next time you call somebody a junkie or even refer to things as hard drug use as opposed to whatever the alternative is.
Yeah. The war on drugs has been a war on people.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
It was never about drugs to begin with. The war on drugs was never about drugs.
Yeah. Well, I can tell you from personal experience, I started using heroin back in the late 60s when Nixon sealed off the Mexican border and stopped marijuana, or didn't stop it, but directly impacted the flow of marijuana across the border from Mexico, and I couldn't get weed. And you know what? When people are in pain and they're looking for relief and they have no other resources, no other coping skills, we do what we need to do to stop the pain. And what I did, because that's all I knew, was I'm going to find something else to get high with.
There's a fantastic book out there. There's actually a number of books that I'd love to recommend, but this one in particular is called Chasing the Scream by Johann Hari, looking at the first and the last days of the war on drugs. And an interesting point is that prior to 1914, people used heroin in this mm-hmm. country. You could go to your doctor, and the doctor would prescribe the heroin in doses. You could inject under the supervision of a doctor, and they had lots of discretion in how to deal with pain management and opiate dependency. But following the Harrison Act of 1914, which criminalized all of that, doctors themselves were thrown in jail for treating their patients.
Mm-hmm.
And there's places in the world, like in Switzerland, for example, where there's a clinic, at least one clinic, that is open where people can go in the morning and get their dose of heroin, and they have the entire rest of the day to get a job, to become active in their community, to build relationships with their family. And this all started because there was a community uproar at the number of used needles that were in public parks. And guess what? As soon as that clinic opened in, I forget which city it was, the number of needles and drug-related crimes plummeted.
Yeah. I've heard that the policies in Portugal are very, very progressive.
Full decriminalization in Portugal.
Yeah, yeah. Mm-hmm.
Harm reduction actually takes a number of different forms all over the world, and that's another thing that Hari's book looks at, is places where it hasn't worked out so well, not harm reduction, but where the war on drugs hasn't worked out so
yeah.
well, and more creative solutions to it and what the results have been.
So do either of you or anyone else from Steady Collective make themselves available to go out and do presentations in the community? If somebody said, I'd really like you to come and speak about what you do and about this issue, you're nodding your head, Michelle?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, yeah. We do that on a pretty regular basis.
Mm-hmm.
We go to health departments and explain what we do,
uh-huh.
why we do it, and how we do it.
And they can reach you at that website, the Steady Collective.
.org, www.thesteadycollective.org.
And they can contact you, and they can also contact Hillary as well. So what we really need is we need education. We need to remove stigma.
Mm-hmm.
We need compassion.
Mm-hmm.
And, of course, on a deeper level, it'd be really nice to to dig in and solve some of the major inequities in our society, but
I think
to
in a
start
term,
with, yeah.
transformative justice is what we
yes.
need around these issues.
Yes. So I want to thank both of you so much
thank
for
you.
Coming on.
Thanks for having us.
Laura Eshelman, who's on the board at the Steady Collective. Are you on the board as well? Or
mm-hmm.
are you okay? And Michelle Guichenet,
mm-hmm.
On the board and out in the trenches, supporting harm reduction and helping people find a compassionate way to live with dignity and reduce harm in the community through the Steady Collective. Thanks so much for joining us this week on A Mindful Emergence.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Anything else you want to say before we say goodbye?
What we give the most at the outreach table is love.
Love. That's what they need.
That's what it is.
Well, thank you for doing the work that you do.
No, thank you.
And thanks to our listeners for tuning in again this week for A Mindful Emergence. And don't forget, the rebroadcast is Thursday morning from 9 to 10 a.m. And you can also get this show as an archive. See you next week.
TV.